Shrink Wrap Radio number 359, Addiction, in the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, with Dr. Gabor Mate.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Gabor Mate, and we'll be discussing his outlook on issues of drug addiction. Gabor Mate, MD, is a physician and best-selling author whose books have been published in nearly 20 languages worldwide. Dr. Mate is highly sought after for his expertise on a range of topics, from addiction and attention deficit disorder to mind-body wellness, adolescent mental health, and parenting. A renowned thinker and public speaker, he addresses audiences all over North America, including professional and academic conventions, as well as presentations and seminars for local community groups and the general public. As a writer and speaker, he's widely known for the power, insight, clarity, candor, compassion, humor, and warmth of his presentations. Common to all of Dr. Mate's work is a focus on understanding the broader context in which human disease and disorders arise, from cancer to autoimmune conditions like multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, ulcerative colitis, or fibromyalgia, childhood behavioral disorders like ADD, oppositionality, or bullying, or addiction, from substance abuse to obsessive gambling, shopping, or even workaholism. Rather than offering facile, quick-fix solutions to these complex issues, Dr. Mate weaves together scientific research, case histories, and his own insights and experience to present a broad perspective that enlightens and empowers people to promote their own healing and that of those around them. His approach is holistic and kaleidoscopic, linking everything from neurophysiology, immunology, and developmental psychology to economic and social policy, and even touches on the spiritual dimensions of disease and healing. His books, all Canadian bestsellers, include Scattered Minds, A Look at the Origins and Healing of Attention Deficit Disorder, When the Body Says No, The Cost of Hidden Stress, Hold On to Your Kids, Why Parents Need to Matter More Than Peers, which was co-written with Gordon Neufeld, and In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction. He's recipient of the 2009 Hubert Evans Prize for Literary Nonfiction. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Gabor Mate, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, it's certainly a pleasure for me. I've been immersing myself in your work, particularly your book In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts on Addiction, and also been discovering quite a bit of your interviews on YouTube, which could lead us off into some other very interesting directions as well. Your book focuses quite a bit on your work in a certain neighborhood of Vancouver, British Columbia. And are you still carrying on that work, or have you moved on?
Well, I'm too busy traveling, speaking, and writing to do the clinical work anymore. I'm still involved and with some individuals, and I'm still involved in training people down there, but no longer in the day-to-day clinical work.
Okay. Well, so we'll be speaking a bit about the past then, I guess, in some ways, because I only just, as a result of seeing things on YouTube, I just sort of tumbled to the notion that, oh, I think he's moved on. So now one of the ways in which you describe yourself in the book is as an infant survivor of Auschwitz. Perhaps you can give us a little background on that.
Well, not exactly of Auschwitz. I never got to Auschwitz.
Oh, okay. I don't think I would have survived
had I got there. But I am Jewish. I was born in Hungary in January 1944, 2 months before the Germans occupied Budapest. And when they did occupy Hungary, then followed the extermination within 3 months of around 400,000 Hungarian Jews, including my grandparents, My mother and I were nearly part of that group, and we were saved from it by history, really. But we were certainly under threat during the first year of my life. And that first year of my life under Nazi occupation, with my mother being as grief-struck and as terrorized as she was, certainly had an impact on my development.
Yes, I wanted to ask you, in fact, what bearing, if any, do you think those early beginnings have had on the fact that you came to work providing palliative care against overwhelming odds to miserably addicted, ill, and hopeless people in a blighted neighborhood of Vancouver?
Well, let's make a distinction. I did work in palliative care for 7 years in Vancouver Hospital. I was the medical director of the palliative care unit. That was different from my addiction work, which followed after that. So I did provide addiction medicine in what is North America's most concentrated area of drug use, which is Vancouver's downtown east side. I did that for 12 years. Prior to that, for 7 years, I was the coordinator of the palliative care unit at Vancouver Hospital. What I do say in a book is that in some ways, working with this addicted population is similar to the palliative care work in that you're very often dealing with people, many of whom will not ever overcome their illness.
And maybe a better term for your approach would have been harm reduction. Would that be a better fit?
Harm reduction was a part of it. I mean, in working with an addicted population, and I haven't answered my question yet, your question yet about my childhood, my infancy, but harm reduction is a part of medicine and addiction medicine work, because for a lot of people, it's just unrealistic, given present circumstances, to think that they're going to give up their addiction. And so in that context, one's efforts are directed towards, at least in the beginning, towards reducing the harm of the addiction to these people, not just the harm to the addiction, but also the harm of the socially retrograde, scientifically backward, and completely unscientific and uncompassionate approach that society takes towards the addict. So we're reducing the harm of the addiction itself, but we're also reducing the harm of social persecution of addicts.
Yes, yes.
Now, that's a part of the work. Now, another part of the work is dealing with people's medical issues, such as HIV and hepatitis and everything else that they have. And then partly it's also you're making the best effort possible to help people overcome their addictions. It's just a question that in that context, that's not a realistic outcome much of the time.
Yes. Now, you said you had not finished answering my first question, so I want to give you the space to do that.
Well, I would say that there are two major factors there. One is that as a result of those early experiences, I've had my own addiction issues. And so I've been very aware that I'm not all that different from the clients. I mean, I'm different in the sense that my addictions are more polite and more respectable. Also, that I am university educated, obviously a highly trained professional with all kinds of advantages in this world, but that in significant ways, the internal psychological and emotional dynamics and neurobiological dynamics that I've experienced are similar to those of my patients. That's the first point. And the second point is, of course, is that I grew up with a very clear sense that people suffer sometimes for no fault of their own, mm-hmm. just because of social indifference. And that is, you can make a case that that was certainly the situation for my family's experience in Eastern Europe, and it's also the experience of many drug addicts in today's society.
Yes, yes. Your book is very eloquent, and it takes us into that neighborhood with you and allows us to vividly experience the pain that you witness, as well as the flashes of joy that come from intense encounters in which all pretense has been stripped away.
Yeah.
The title of your book is In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. Can you tell us a bit about where that title comes from and what it signifies here?
It's a Buddhist image. In the Buddhist symbology, people cycle through six realms, which represent different aspects, I believe, of human existence. The six realms include the human realm, which is our ordinary selves. And then there's the animal realm, which is our appetites and our drives, what you might call our id. Then there is the hell realm of painful, unbearable emotions. And one of the other realms is the realm of hunger ghosts, in which the creatures are depicted as ones with large empty bellies, small scrawny necks, tiny mouths, so that emptiness within can never be filled from the outside. And so they haunt their lives, always trying to satiate that unbearable emptiness. And that's the realm of addiction. And, of course, it's not a question that some people are there all the time and others are never there. I think most of us go through all these realms, maybe even the course of a single day. This is a point I make in my book. And the hungry ghost realm is that of the realm of addictions. And my sense is that people inhabit that realm as their attempt to escape the hell realm of painful terror and distress.
Yes, yes. I have some personal experience with those realms. Part one of your book takes us into the trenches with you and introduces us to some of the personalities that you've worked with, and you deftly underscore not only their intense pain and hopelessness, but also their humanity and beauty. To give us a sense of that, I'm wondering if you can take us through one of those cases or sketches, either one from the book or one since the book was finished.
Well, I'll tell you about a happier case, actually. Okay. One that's not in the book. A woman, a patient of mine, who I'll call Cynthia, that actually is her name. She's a native Canadian woman and Aboriginal, native Indian, you might say. Now, as you know from American history, the Aboriginal people here were horribly treated by the colonizers, the Caucasians who came from Europe. At times the wars were, that was a genocidal extermination and all kinds of abuse that they were subjected to. Same thing in Canada. And so these people are blighted with histories of multi-generational trauma, including for 100 years in this country until quite recently, Native kids were forcibly abducted from their parents coerced into attending these residential schools. Mm-hmm. Not only was every effort made to eradicate the Indian out of them, but they were also sexually and physically abused after generations and generations, which means that trauma has become now endemic in the Native communities, and traumatized multi-generationally. Then they end up traumatizing the next generation themselves.
Yes.
This is what happens to trauma. It becomes a multi-generational chain. So Cynthia had a childhood where she was traumatized, sexually abused, and so on. And she was living in the downtown east side of Vancouver doing heroin and cocaine and whatever else and overdosing and nearly dying. And she's lost her four children and had very little chance of surviving. But because she came to some work that I was leading with an Amazonian plant called ayahuasca, actually, which is a shamanic plant, and she participated in shamanic ceremonies, she's now completely free of her drugs.
That's wonderful, and I had only just discovered before this interview, as I started looking through some of the YouTubes, that you have gotten into that work, and I want to come back to that in some depth later on in the interview, if we can do that.
The reason I mentioned Cynthia is because she's not in my book, but there are people in my book with similar histories who have since died. There's a young woman who is in one of the early chapters. The chapter is called "You Wouldn't Believe My Life Story."
Yes, I remember that one.
And this woman had a child when she was 15 or 16. She herself had been abandoned in infancy by her mother, who was also 16 when she had her. And when she had her child, she came to the downtown east side looking for her mother, who she found living in a hotel, who injected her with heroin, stole her money, and prostituted her.
Yeah, what betrayal.
And, betrayal, yes, but really what it was the acting out of the generations of trauma that her people had been subjected to. And that woman, whose story is told in some detail in the book, died a month after the book was published. She died of a brain abscess.
Yes.
So I mentioned Cynthia's story because thank God, it doesn't always end like that, and that there is a possibility of transformation, no matter how, what you suffered, as long as the right support is available.
Right, right. Well, you emphasize the traumatic history quite a bit. What about the quotes, addictive personality? You write that you found that a painful history of extraordinary trauma, and you found actually a painful history of extraordinary trauma and abuse in each of the addicts that you've worked with. And if I recall correctly, you say that their substance abuse serves the function of numbing their pain. Can you say a bit more about that?
Well, first of all, it's not just my personal observation. There's large-scale population studies in the United States called the Adverse Childhood Experience Studies, which clearly show that the more adversity a child experiences, the greater the risk of addiction exponentially. So that if there's factors such as sexual, emotional, or physical abuse, the death of a parent, addiction in the family, violence in the family, a parent being jailed, a parent being mentally ill, a parent being addicted, for each of these adverse childhood experiences, the risk of addiction goes up exponentially. And there's no question that the more trauma a person experiences in childhood, the significantly greater the risk of addiction. So that's hardly controversial. It's just how it is. In fact, what is extraordinary is not that it should be that way, but that it is that way, and so few physicians recognize it.
Yes.
So most addictions physicians really don't know much about trauma at all, even though every patient they see was traumatized. So that's what's extraordinary. And the trauma, of course, creates that pain. Now, Keith Richards, the Rolling Stone guitarist, says it very well in his own autobiography called Life. He says that, talking about his own heroin addiction, he says, it was all about the search for oblivion. He said, the contortions we go through just not to be ourselves for a few hours. If you look at what the medications do, every single one of them is a pain reliever. I mean, the opiates like heroin, OxyContin, Dilaudid, codeine, morphine, these are all painkillers. Not just physical, but emotional painkillers. Cocaine is a local anesthetic. It numbs nerve endings. Alcohol is a painkiller. What do you say about somebody who's drunk too much? You say he's feeling no pain.
Yes.
Cannabis is an analgesic and a useful one. So all the drugs of abuse virtually either directly numb pain or they distract you from it.
Yeah.
So behind addiction in every single case is significant emotional pain.
And one of the things that you emphasize that that it's the substances are also a way of holding at bay their fear of living, that so-called normal life is more frightening than their addictive behavior and the toll it takes, it exacts in terms of illness and loss and so on.
Well, of course, why would anybody be afraid of living? It's because life has been so frightening, you know, when they were helpless.
Yes.
So that fear of life reflects childhood experiences, purely and simple.
Right. And I was particularly moved by your description of how trapped these addicts are, living in a kind of jail or ghetto without physical bars or walls. The walls that hem them in are the judgments of the straight world and their own sense of unworthiness, which, as you point out, comes from their traumatic history.
Well, children are pure narcissists in the sense that they take everything personally, like everything is because of them. So if a child is treated well, and the parents are happy on the child naturally comes to believe that it's because of him or her, and then they have a good sense of themselves. But the obverse is also true, that when you're abused or treated badly, or living with parents who are emotionally themselves very stressed and their lives are fraught with misery, the child takes that personally as well. And then the self-image is that of somebody who's not worthy.
Yes.
So people that becomes a trap, as you say. That becomes a prison. So there's the prison of the negative self-image. There's the prison of the pain that you need to escape. There's also the prison that we haven't talked about yet, which is just the neurobiology, which is shaped by early experience. And finally, there's the prison, the significant one, of the judgments of the so-called straight world.
Yes.
And not just the judgments, by the way, but also the retrograde and horrendously cruel war on drugs, so-called war on drugs. I mean, even the phrase war on drugs is a euphemism. there's no war on drugs because you can't make war on inanimate objects. You can only make war on human beings. Mm-hmm. People that the war on drugs makes war on are the drug addicts, who are the very people that were abused in the first place, which is why they ended up as drug addicts.
Yes.
Not only were people traumatized in childhood, they continue to be traumatized by a society that blames them for trying to soothe their pain by substances that for some completely unfathomable reason are illegal, whereas other substances that are much more dangerous to your health, for example, cigarettes and alcohol, are legal. So we have layers upon layers of fences surrounding these people, some of them internal and of course some of them imposed by a completely irrational social attitude towards them.
Yeah, yeah, I'm definitely on the same page with you there. One of the things that I'm moved by in your book is your continual self-disclosure and also your constantly working at being as authentic as possible. And throughout the narrative, sometimes you catch yourself being judgmental and being less than your highest self. And in doing that, you give us a window into your inner dialogue and process. And as a result, I think we as readers recognize parts of ourselves. I certainly, as a clinician, as a person, I'm aware of my judgments and a repugnant kind of reaction sometimes to people who seem different, you know, in dramatic ways.
Well, the best comment on that is the one by Jesus where he says, before you try to remove the sliver from your brother's eye, mm-hmm. the pole from your own eye.
Yes.
And generally, when we perceive other people in a judgmental way, it's because they mirror something inside of us that we don't want to acknowledge or accept about ourselves. So when I was dealing with my drug addicted clients, there was nothing about them that I didn't also see in myself. Nothing at all. So that their emptiness, their hunger, their search for meaning and satiation from the outside, their dishonesty, their manipulation, their denial, these are all things I recognize about myself. And some days I recognize them more than others. And the days when I didn't want to recognize it, then I'd have my judgments about them.
Yes, yeah, and that comes out beautifully in the narrative. You referred to this earlier. One of your self-disclosures is your self-confrontation around your own addiction to classical music, of all things. My first reaction was, come on, this is a bit of a stretch. But as I read on, learning that you were spending thousands of dollars in a couple of days or a week on CDs that you might not even ever get around to listening to, and your description of the shame that you felt about the ways that this behavior would lead to lying to your wife and distancing yourself from your wife and your daughter, it helped me to see that, in fact, there was an addictive quality to it that even culminated in your attending an AA session. So perhaps you can fill that out a bit more for our listeners.
Well, first of all, David, I wasn't addicted to classical music. I was addicted to shopping for classical music.
Okay, yes.
I mean, I love classical music. I still do. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a great passion, you know, in classical music.
Sure.
It's all music, and different music will speak to or call to different people. But for me, classical music is one of the highest, is for me, the highest form of human creativity and genius. And emotionally, it resonates on so many different levels.
So tell us about the addiction to shopping then.
So it's not the classical music per se. It's the need to shop for it. And that's different. Because the shopping meant that even when I bought something, it was never enough. I would never stay home and listen to it. If it was the music that I was so taken with, which I was, but if it was purely the music, I would then just really enjoy it and stay home and listen to it. But it's that need to acquire more and more and to shop and to leave my business, to leave my practice, to leave my work, to leave my family and at all times and get more music and to have that momentary hit, that momentary satisfaction, and then the urge to go back an hour later and culminating in that 1 week where, as you say, I spent $8,000. That's what the addiction is. So the addiction is not to the music per se. It's to the acquisition of music which is not very different from the heroin addict who gets their hit and 4 hours later has to have another one.
So you make the point that addiction exists on a continuum from substance abuse to somewhat more benign behavioral forms. How can listeners recognize the addictive behavior in themselves?
Well, that's if you define, depends how you define addiction. And my definition of addiction is any behavior that a person enjoys, finds some relief or pleasure in, craves, but which carries negative consequences, and you continue in it without, despite those negative consequences. Now, notice I've said nothing about substances. Any behavior that you crave, that you find pleasure and relief in, that has negative consequences and you have no control over, you can't give it up. That's an addiction. So that means you could be addicted to work, to exercise, or you can work normally and you can exercise responsibly and not be addicted at all. So it's not the external behavior, it's the internal relationship to it. What's driving it?
Yes.
And does it have a negative consequence?
Right.
So if you work so much that you ignore your spiritual needs and your physical needs and your family and your relationships, and you can't stand it when you're not working, you've got an addiction. Now, it doesn't matter how it looks from the outside. You might look like a responsible employee or a really dedicated company executive, but if internally that's how you relate to it, you've got an addiction problem, and you're going to suffer for it and create suffering in the people around you.
Yes.
It's the same with exercise, same with anything else. And furthermore, if you look at the brain biology of addictive behaviors, it doesn't matter if you're addicted to sex or the internet or gambling, work, shopping, or heroin or crystal meth or cocaine. It's the same brain circuits and the same brain chemicals and the same emotional dynamics that are implicated. So that addiction really is in a continuum. And the fact that I had a respectable addiction to work, which meant that people really admired the way I practiced medicine, which also meant that I ignored my family and didn't take care of myself, or that I had an addiction to such a beautiful activity as listening to classical music, or in my case, shopping for it. All this is very respectable. A few blocks away, my addicted clients are doing cocaine or heroin because they were more traumatized than I was. That's the only difference. So that the continuum of suffering and the continuum of addictive manifestation engulfs, I think, most of us in this society, which is all the more reason why we like to judge and exclude the drug addict, because we just don't want to recognize our similarity.
Yeah, they are our shadow, so to speak. How does addiction affect the brain? What kinds of changes does it produce?
Well, before you go there, we have to look at before the addiction affects the brain affects the addiction.
Yeah, it's a two-way street.
Because the circuits that are implicated in addiction later on develop or don't develop in a healthy way based on early environment. So, see, what we know now is that the human brain develops under the impact of the environment, and particularly under the impact of the mutual responsiveness of adult-child relationships. So when children are brought up in circumstances of emotional deprivation or worse, abuse and trauma, key brain circuits don't develop, which means that those key brain circuits then are the templates for the addictive behavior later on. So that the biology of addiction is very much potentiated by stress early in life. Stress not just after birth, but even stress on the pregnant mother. You can stress pregnant women as you don't do it experimentally, but if you look at abused women, for example, that have higher levels of the stress hormone, cortisol in their placenta, and delivery, and their kids will be more likely to be diagnosed with conditions that predispose to addiction later on. Stress pregnant animals in the laboratory, and their offspring will be more likely to use cocaine and alcohol to soothe themselves as adults. I'm talking of before birth.
Yes.
So that the brain, so it's not just that the addiction affects the brain biology, it's that the brain biology itself is affected by early trauma and early stress in such a way as to make addictions much more likely to take on an unresistible pull in that particular individual. Now, then, of course, addictive behaviors of any kind, but particularly with substances, of course, will also have an effect on the brain. So that the longer you're doing a substance, the more you can track negative brain changes, which also makes it more difficult for you to make the right decisions. Which is one more reason why it's stupid to blame people for their addictions. A, they didn't create the brain biology that has become their lot owing to their early stress and trauma. And B, the substances themselves harm the brain in such a way as to make rational decision making more difficult. So to further punish people and to judge them and ostracize them for it, rather than treating them compassionately, is not only inhumane, it's also unscientific.
Yes, yes. Now, what do we know about genetics in relation to this addiction?
Well, there's what we think we know and what we actually do know. What we think we know, if you look at the American Society of Addiction Medicine, they still define addiction as a condition that's about 50% determined by genes, which is utter nonsense. I would say that not even 5% is determined by genes. If you actually look at genes, the long and short of it is that genes are turned on and off by the environment. So according to studies both in animals and in human beings, even individuals who might have some genes that may predispose them to addictions will never become addicted if the nurturing circumstances are right. In other words, genes are turned on and off by the appropriate environment. And so children who may inherit those genes, but if they're nurtured well, those genes are not activated. They're activated only if the child is badly treated. And the same is true with animals. And so that genes don't determine, even if they're present, they don't determine addictive behavior. At the very most, they might provide some predisposition. But most of the predisposition has got nothing to do with genes. It's got to do with early childhood experience and trauma and emotional loss. And of course, I'm not going to go into the science of it, except to say that the logic on which the studies are based, the twin studies, are laughably shallow. In fact, they're ridiculously shallow. It's amazing that they don't see the falsehood of their own logic here. To argue, for example, that because something runs in a family, it must be genetic is ridiculous. Because if you're a psychologist and your father was a psychologist and your daughter becomes a psychologist, does that mean that psychology is a genetic disease? I mean, it could be, right? It could be.
Yeah.
But it doesn't prove it, because maybe you can recreate conditions from one generation to the next where similar lines of development will occur. And that's what you see in addiction, is multi-generational trauma. So you don't have to resort to genetics at all to explain addictions. Now, if they play a role, it's a small one.
Have you had an opportunity to debate some of the scientists who are involved in that research about your point of view?
I don't debate them personally. I explain, provide the scientific basis in the book. There's an appendix that deals with the genetic base of addiction or the lack of it, and I provide all the scientific references, but I haven't been in personal debate. I've talked to medical audiences. I don't usually get much argument from them. Usually I get a lot of silence, but not a lot of argument. There's not much there to argue with.
Yes, yeah.
Silence. I agree. And the silence is always interesting.
Yes.
Because it means a kind of discomfort without knowing how to engage with it.
Right. Right. You pose some interesting questions at the beginning of your book, and one of them, and you sort of propose that you're going to answer them as one goes on in the book, or that you're going to discover them in the process of writing the book. And so one of those questions was, is there such a thing as an addictive personality, that some people are doomed ahead of time because they that personality and others don't? Maybe you've been speaking to that.
Well, there's an addictive personality, but nobody's doomed.
Mm-hmm.
Number one. Number two, what is the personality? The personality is nothing that you're born with. You're born with a temperament, but nobody's born with a personality. The personality develops in interaction with the environment. And of much of what we call the personality is actually a coping mechanism. So, for example, you might say about somebody that they're a control freak, right?
Right.
That's their personality. They're a control freak. But nobody's born a control freak. People are just born very sensitive. And if their environment is out of control, then they'll learn that the way to survive is to control everything. That becomes their personality. But that's just a coping mechanism. So similarly, there's addictive personality with a sense of insatiable emptiness, inadequate emotional differentiation. So you get to get overwhelmed by the emotional states of other people that you're in relationship with. Various other features, but that doesn't mean that you were born with those features, nor does it mean that you're doomed to have those features, because the personality, again, is not who we are. The personality is simply a representation of our coping mechanisms that we've had to develop as children, and it's not written in stone. It may be wired in very deeply, but it's not necessarily that we're doomed to with it. In fact, we can clarify and transform the personality depending on how committed we are to the personal growth.
That kind of relates to another one of those questions that you posed, which was, how much choice does the addict really have? And you talked about society kind of persecuting addicts, which in a way would seem to imply that they don't have choice. So,
choice really is an interesting question, because choice is nothing absolute. You know, you might say, for example, that I have freedom of choice as to, after I lock my door, if I check to see if it's locked or not, okay?
Yeah.
But what if I'm obsessive compulsive? Then how much choice do I really have? Then I might be driven to check that lock 100 times before I leave the house. So how much choice do I actually have?
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, our choices are limited by our internal programming, especially if that programming is unconscious. So women, for example, who were traumatized, abused as children, will very often end up with men who traumatize them, who abuse them. How much choice did they really have? They were actually programmed to seek abusive men as their partners. And it's very difficult for them to behave in other ways.
Yeah.
So choice is never absolute. Choice exists in a context. You might say that the American electorate has a choice who they're going to vote for in the election. But how much choice do they really have when only very rich people can actually run, given the way the American system works? Then how much choice do people actually have? And furthermore, when the information on which they vote comes from a media that's tightly controlled and highly manipulated, so how much freedom is there really in this free country of yours, or any free country, so-called free country for that matter? In other words, choices are not abstract, they're practical issues. Now, when it comes to the brain of the drug addict, when the brain has been programmed by a certain neurobiological development that has to do with early childhood, that greatly reduces choice. And if you actually look at, and when you actually recognize that much of human behavior, especially when it comes to the big decisions, is really unconscious. People don't really know why they decide most things. Nobody decides why they're going to marry somebody else. You fall in love. You haven't decided to fall in love with that person most of the time. It just happens. You have no idea why it happens. Now, typically what you find out is that you married somebody that's going to bring back precisely your childhood emotions. That's why people get so surprised by their marriages. I didn't sign up for this. The fact is they did. but they didn't know why they were signing up for it.
Yeah.
So the thing about when most decisions are unconscious, when the brain is programmed in certain ways, then choice is actually limited. So the real issue is, what will promote choice? What will allow people to make free choice? And what promotes free choice is consciousness, is awareness. So the more aware we are, the more choice we actually have.
Yeah.
Most people who become addicts are unconscious. They're driven. It happens as a response to pain. It happens at a time when they're young and unaware and largely without knowledge of who they are and why they do what they do. How can we talk about choice? And furthermore, then the drugs damage the brain further, which reduces its rational capacity. So I'm not saying there's no choice at all. And I am saying that the identification of choice has to be the goal of addiction treatment. But just to make the bland assumption that we all have freedom of choice is just not congruent with reality.
Yeah, I'm thinking about your earlier reference to the war on drugs and how that's a failure. And so there's the issue when it comes to choice and psychological states and so on, that the law tends to look at it differently than psychologists and psychiatrists do.
Well, the law assumes that people are making a choice.
Yes.
And if people are making a choice that has negative consequences for them or for society, then the way you deal with it is you punish them for it so as to deter others. So the whole logic behind the criminal justice system is that people are acting out of choice. If you actually understood that people were not acting out of choice, there'd be no justification at all for the war on drugs. None whatsoever. Zero. Now, as Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, whose work you might know, he's a professor of psychiatry at Boston University and a world expert on trauma, said that 100% of the inmates of the criminal justice system are actually traumatized children. But who chooses to be a traumatized child? But these are the people that we fill our prisons with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you have a war on drugs in Canada?
Oh, yes. We're great followers of the American way. Our current government is spending billions of dollars toughing up the drug laws, building more jails, incarcerating people longer. And as a result, of course, lacking the money for psychological and rehab services. So that everything that has failed and has failed spectacularly and notoriously in your country is now being emulated here in mine.
Yeah.
This is the brilliance and humanity of our own government here.
I watched one of your talks on YouTube where you spoke about having returned from a 10-day Vipassana meditation retreat, and you realized that you spend too much time distracting yourself with work, something I can totally identify with, and you said you were going to take a year-long sabbatical to get to know yourself better.
I don't think I said year-long. I did say I'll take a sabbatical.
Okay. maybe I misheard it. Have you taken that sabbatical?
Or maybe I've forgotten what I promised myself. I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah.
I am going to take a sabbatical. I've spent much of the last year, well, more than a year, but since last summer, traveling and speaking all over the place. I've just come back from a 5-day trip that took me to Vermont and various places in Canada. And before then, I was gone for 2.5 and 3.5 weeks, respectively, from Brazil to Northern Ontario to Las Vegas to Albany, New York. And
that doesn't sound like that sabbatical has happened yet.
No, it hasn't happened yet. But yeah. What I was about to say is that I'm home this week now, and then I have a few more days of travel in next week, and then I'm going to start a 2-month. Where I'm mostly going to be on our summer place on a beautiful Gulf island here in British Columbia. And in the fall, although I'll be doing traveling, I'll be not be doing this extensive traveling for speaking. And I intend to take a lot of time over the next year staying at home and quite probably beginning to write my next book and just developing a different life pattern where I'm not out there so much traveling and speaking all the time, which by the way, really enjoyed because I love the speaking, I love the teaching, I love the response, I love meeting people all over the place, but at the same time, it's time to do something different.
Yes, yes. And one of the different things that you've been doing is that you've become involved with ayahuasca, and, you know, in the book you talked about struggling with your own process of self-discovery and getting to know yourself better discovering that there was a lot of underlying anxiety. So what was your experience with ayahuasca in terms of getting to know yourself and the encounter with anxiety?
Well, ayahuasca is a brew that's made out of two plants in the Amazon, and it's one of these plants that by the shamans, the medicine men and women in the Amazon, have used for hundreds, maybe thousands of years as a source of visions and insight. And after my book was published, I received many questions about what I knew about ayahuasca and the treatment of addiction. I knew nothing about them. As a physician, why would I have? But then I found out and had the opportunity to experience it myself. And it really is, under the right circumstances, with the right guidance, with the proper ceremony, it really is a plant, or it's a substance that opens up the heart and opens up emotional networks in the brain that were maybe sequestered or largely closed in childhood. So it's a process that allows people, in the right guidance, again, I emphasize, in the right context only, it's a modality that helps people get to know themselves and to let go of old patterns, including addictive patterns. So it's no panacea, but it's a wonderful modality that goes way beyond what most people in the Western medical system can experience.
So again, what was the impact on you?
The first impact on me is that I just experienced love in a very deep way. Not love for anybody in particular, although that too, but just love, you know, and my heart really opened up and I had tears of joy, such as I'd never experienced before.
Beautiful.
And when you experience that, when you realize that that's actually who you are, that's a part of you, then there's much less of a reason to keep running away then, to keep chasing something on the outside, when you realize that the truth of love, the completeness of it, is internal to all of us. Why keep running to the outside then? Now, it's not as simple as that, because the old patterns can reassert themselves. It's one thing to participate in a ceremony. It's quite another to come back to life in this culture and try and maintain that awareness.
Yes.
But it's an opening that one doesn't forget. And one can relate to life differently. It's a gradual process. For some people, it's immediately transformative. It's not for everybody, for sure. And yet for others, it's something that opens doors that they keep walking through. And each time they do, they find more liberation.
Mm-hmm. Again, from YouTube, I gather you've started leading ayahuasca retreats. Is there any legal risk in your doing that?
Well, I've been warned by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation that actually did a documentary on my work with addiction and ayahuasca. And the results are great in that people that were addicted before are not addicted anymore. But they still informed me that it's illegal and were I to continue with it, I might incur some legal sanctions. So I no longer do this work in Canada, but that doesn't mean I've dropped my interest or activity on it, because it's such a powerful healing modality. So that's the most I will say about it at this point.
Sure. Well, that's really, really tragic that research and practice have really been so closed down in both of our countries in terms of the potential of using substances.
Oh, well, let me tell you about another substance.
Yeah.
If you want something totally amazing, there's an African substance called ibogaine, ibogaine, or iboga is the plant. Ibogaine is the active ingredient in the plant. You can have somebody who's a heroin addict for 2 decades, or maybe on methadone maintenance, or Suboxone, or something else, and they can do ibogaine, again, under the right circumstances, with the right guidance only. I emphasize that.
Sure.
If they do it with the proper supervision and support, they can do the ibogaine once, and then maybe another times in the following week, and they'll have no withdrawal from their opiate. No withdrawal whatsoever. Now, I wouldn't have believed it had I not witnessed it myself.
Yes.
But I'm telling you, I know since then, I've sent several people for this treatment, always with great success. So people that would long-term opiate addicts are no longer because of this illegal plant. In my country, it's not illegal, by the way. In yours, it is, apparently, I've been told.
Oh, that's amazing. And it's, again, it's tragic that there can't be more open experimentation.
Well, you know, and the irony, of course, is that both on ayahuasca and on ibogaine, there's been lots of research. Lots of research. You know, I mean, lots of scientific research has been done. Lots of doctors have worked with it. These are not fly-by-night unknown little modalities. They've been looked at extensively, but their practical application is completely limited by the complete irrationality of the regulations.
Yes. Well, where do you see your work going in the future? I guess both your inner work and your outer work.
Well, you know, if I look at if there's any theme in my life as to what's driving me, I have this tremendous thirst for truth, just knowing how things are.
Mm-hmm.
And in helping people become aware of the truth of their own lives. So in one form or another, that's going to continue no matter what I do. And because my work is reasonably well known now, I've attracted some great support in my life that's going to help me take the work further. And it can never be a question of external versus internal work. It's if you don't do the internal work, you also can't do the external work, or at least it'll suffer significantly.
Yes.
So know that the more I learn about myself, the more I can feel comfortable in my own skin, the more effective my work out there in the world becomes as well.
Well, that's probably a great place for us to wrap it up. That's a kind of a great close, I think. So, Dr. Gabor Mate, thanks for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's a great pleasure to speak with you. May I just mention my website?
Yes, please do.
Which is www.drgabormate.com. So it's drgabormate.com. Where people can find out all about my books that I've written, articles that I've written. They can download chapters of the books. And as you also mentioned, there are many lectures and interviews of mine on YouTube that people can also check out.
Yes.
I thank you for this opportunity, and thank you. It's really a pleasure to speak with you.
I think I was a bit intimidated by Dr. Mate after reading his book, and as a consequence, I felt like I was having a little bit of difficulty finding my own comfort spot during the interview. His book is so well written. The narratives of his case histories read like short stories complete with dialogue. It really seemed like it was happening in the moment, and I wondered, how could he remember this dialogue, or was he somehow recreating it? In part, I think my discomfort also was because I only realized a little before the interview that he is no longer engaged in the work described in the book, not still engaged with the ideas and beliefs you heard him articulate, but he's no longer working in the clinic in that blighted Vancouver neighborhood that he wrote about. I wanted to engage him on topics that were currently alive for him, and it felt like we finally got there when we began speaking about ayahuasca toward the end. I think the other reason I felt somewhat intimidated, aside from the excellence of his book, is that we actually share a lot of values and issues in common, and I wasn't sure how to get that across to build that empathetic bridge with him. One personal anecdote that comes to mind in relation to drug addiction is something one of my supervisors told me when I was interning at a VA hospital during graduate school. She shared that she had taken heroin once, just to see what it was like. This was a rather shocking revelation to me because she was an older and very straight or conservative-seeming woman. She told me that the effect of the heroin was to immediately remove all pain, that it lifted her out of all the chronic pains that she wasn't even aware of, and that she never wanted to return to her painful body. That story was enough to warn me off of trying heroin even once. I know that I'd find that release from all the pains of existence very seductive, too much so for me to want to take a chance. I certainly agree with Dr. Mate that the war on drugs is wrong-headed, and has had disastrous effects. And you know from past interviews that I strongly feel that plant medicines like ayahuasca and mescaline have great therapeutic potential. And I think it's a tragedy that our country has gone to such great lengths to make it impossible for scientists and therapists to responsibly explore their therapeutic and spiritual uses. Dr. Mate's anecdotal story about Cynthia being freed from her longtime addiction was moving and powerful, as was his reference to the African plant that seems to eliminate withdrawal. I've long held that one cure for addiction is a religious conversion experience. I believe these plant medicines have the potential to induce such a conversion experience. And of course, I completely agree with him that a ritual context with a wise and experienced guide is essential for a good result. So it should be clear that I give a big thumbs up to his book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, and I'd encourage you to use the Amazon.com widget on our site to order your copy. I've not read his other books, but I'm sure they're excellent as well. And as you heard us mention, there are very fine clips from his interviews and lectures on YouTube.
Thomas here from upstate New York. I just want to say that I listened to my first podcast, number 354, What Aging Men Want, and I was prompted immediately to make a modest donation of $20. First, because I received the most prompt and personal customer service I have ever gotten when I called in a question to Dr. Dave about shrink wrap radio. But much more significantly, after listening to just one program, I was inspired to get off the dime I had been sitting on procrastinating for weeks about contacting a shrink. And to boot, as a result of Dr. Robinson's interview, I have picked up a copy of The Odyssey to reread after 50 years since reading it the first time in high school. If you are into value, think about what you get. In today's economy, where a $20 bill doesn't buy you what a $10 bill bought in a grocery store just a year ago, you get, with Shrink Wrap Radio, hundreds of entertaining, insightful, and helpful discussions. They are free. Yes, indeed, and that is real value. But still, to help out with a few bucks, it is still real value when you think of this vast resource just waiting for you to discover new areas of enlightenment. Myself, I hate exercising, but I love listening. And now I'm walking more and longer because I am now listening to Shrink Wrap Radio on my MP3 player. Chip in and you will get a lot of value for your contribution, and you will feel good about doing so, just as I did. Thanks.
And thank you, listener Tom. I really appreciate the sincerity of your message, and I'm glad to welcome you into the Shrink Wrap Radio family. We have a new transcript on the site. It's number 348, Nutrition and Mental Health with Whole Psychiatry founder Robert Hedaya, MD. And I want to thank first-time transcriber Robert Hampton for that. If you'd like to try your hand at transcribing a favorite episode, go to the Transcripts tab to make sure it hasn't already been transcribed or spoken for, and then drop me a line letting me know of your willingness. Don't forget to let your friends, fellow students, colleagues, and family know about Shrink Wrap Radio. There really is something here for everybody, I think, and I'm always trying to grow our community. Also, if you have a relevant psychological service or website or book that you'd like to advertise with a link in our right-hand sidebar for a very modest rate, I must say, let me know and I'll get back to you with the rate.
Hi, this is Jessica Grogan, historian and author of the 2013 book Encountering America, and you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
And what a book it is, but more about that in a bit. First, let's dip into some recent emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. For starters, Greg posted the following comment in response to my interview on number 356 with Danielle Shapook on relationships, dating, and disability. Greg writes, "The podcast series is, in my opinion, a priceless contribution to raising the consciousness of a global community to a wide spectrum of psychological issues. Particularly useful have been the episodes on the depth psychology of C.G. Jung and his descendants and their perspectives on the personal collective unconscious, as well as the archetypes as cosmic ordering and regulating principles verifiable in the phenomenal external world and in the internal world of the psyche. As the podcasts are valuable for continuing education points, they are of untold value to professionals as well as people with an interest in the evolution of mind. As Jung believed, humankind carries the evolution of the cosmos and of the species within the unconscious psyche. Well, Greg, thank you for those observations. They really support what I'm trying to do here. And so I appreciate that, and I appreciate your counterbalancing a rather negative comment that was left on that same site, that same in response to that same interview. I don't think it was really in response to the interview so much as just kind of a general comment as well. Next, we hear from Scott, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I'm a longtime listener or downloader. Well, I have been listening for a year, but I guess that 1 year equals 10 years in the digital age. The reason why I write is that I would love to read the transcript from the Dan Siegel interview, but the link on your site and in your last newsletter takes you through to a subscription-only link. I would like it to use it for a paper I'm writing. I'm a trainee clinical hypnotherapist, and I'm struck by the parallels with the work that Dan is doing and what I'm learning. I promise to donate when I am more resourced financially, when I finish my formal studies, for we never stop studying in this profession. I appreciate all that you are doing, and I'm constantly inspired by your interviews. The only criticism I have is that I'm spending way too much on books after listening to your guests. Kindest regards from London," and that's from Scott. And what happened with that Dan Siegel interview is that the Neuropsychotherapist magazine / journal did such a beautiful job of re-rendering the transcript that I had on my site, adding beautiful artwork and really high production values, that I used their version, not realizing that you had to be a subscriber then in order to get the transcript. Now, I'm not sure if you have to be a paid subscriber or not, to tell you the truth, but I reverted back to my standard transcript format, and so that transcript with Dan Siegel is now available, easily available on the site for Scott and anybody else who would like it. Finally, we hear from Chris, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I really enjoy listening to your podcast and am now on episode 250. Of course, there are some that resonate with me more than others, although each one has something to offer with a frequent gold nugget or aha moment. Of special interest was episode 148 on ego state psychotherapy. Most of us go through certain periods in our life where a particular subject really captures our imagination and parts work is of its time for me right at this moment, or at least part of me thinks so. There is a guy I know in Scotland who has been practicing therapy for 30 years or more and is using hypnosis to access parts in a way that is quite unusual, but is getting some very good results. Keep up the good work. Kind regards, Chris." And the episode that you refer to was with Sarah Hanna Radcliffe, and she's going to be my guest again before too much longer. She's written a new book, and she's always been a wonderful guest when I've had her on. So that's something for us all to look forward to. And speaking of parts work, I'm wondering if your hypnotherapist friend in Scotland hasn't been influenced by Bandler and Grinder, who did a lot of hypnotic work and who were the founders of NLP, Neuro-Linguistic Programming. And I took a workshop with them many years ago and when they were first starting out, and it was very much about speaking to the different inner parts. And so I suspect that your friend maybe has been influenced by Bandler and Grinder. Well, I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-350-9918. Thanks to Gabor Mate, MD, for sharing his experiences around addiction. And as I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with Dr. Jessica Grogan, who has written a fantastic book tracing the rise and some would say fall of humanistic psychology. If you really want to understand where Dr. Dave came from, you won't want to miss this one. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Shrink Wrap Radio, all the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.